This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in. What a weekend. We heard Donald Trump bragging about how he sexually assaults women. Then it seemed like the Republican Party was falling apart. Then last night's debate happened, and this morning we're reassessing with New York Times columnist Tim Egan, based in Seattle and sitting across from me. Hey, Tim.
Hey, great to be with you.
How do you react to all of this?
Well, you know, it was you alluded to it. It was a Category 5 hurricane of news, and sometimes these things, when a storm is upon you, they come so fast you can't really see how much damage there's been. It's now Monday, and it's clear in Seattle, and we are looking at the damage, and it looks like it's been sizable. If you take this thing as one event from Friday when the tape of Trump's talking about sexually assaulting women and being a predator, it was released, to today, where Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, the highest-ranking Republican on the House side, has said he cannot campaign for this man, and put it in one hole, I think you can say this election is – this is what Paul Ryan told his comrades today in a private conversation, is largely over. And coupled with a new poll out today, Wall Street Journal poll that shows double-digit lead for Clinton for the first time, this is a poll that takes in the Friday tape. Now, I never say over when it's over because there could be a terrorist attack. There could be something brilliant. So I'm not one saying that. But the politicals are conveying this information today that they think it's over. It's every man for yourself. Republicans, try to save yourself.
You know, it's a hall of mirrors. You know, I went into the debate thinking the election was over because I've been flipping around on my phone and reading all the talking. And then during and after the debate, honestly, I felt like, why do I keep fooling myself that the election's over when it never really is? And we've been wrong all along.
Right. Well, you know, politics 101, when you're behind, is you have to move the needle a little bit. You have to get people who wouldn't be attracted to you. The Trump performance last night was a straight base performance, dial back. It was a Drudge Report, Limbaugh, go for your – and then they are stirred up today, and they feel fortified. But you are down to base bedrock with Trump right now, which is about 40%. So women watching this event, according to the CNN poll, which is a science poll, not an online poll, overwhelmingly were appalled by Trump's performance last night. Some of it was just body language, that the way his body, the 6 foot – three, if you believe his latest thing, hovering over this woman, saying he's going to put his opponent in jail. Some of that was a straight body language dynamic that is not playing well for the people he most needs, which are women with a college degree.
What did you think of the GOP chair in Washington State, Susan Hutchinson? Her reaction was made national news, right? That he said that when he was a Democrat, and he was channeling Bill Clinton. This is the sex assault
right.
Recordings.
So just so your listeners are clued into this, of course, Susan Hutchinson, the GOP chair, seemed to dismiss what Trump says in the tape. She said, well, he was a Democrat when he said that, as if that makes it any different. In fact, he said he had voted for Bush at the time, but I guess his party affiliation in New York was a Democrat. It made Susan Hutchinson a laughingstock. She was trending on Twitter for most of the weekend. He was singled out as one of the two or three craziest responses to it. There are calls for her to resign today.
Is it a fireable offense?
It's hard to say, but she dismisses this, and that's what's awful. I mean, you're trying. Here's a man, as Anderson Cooper said during the debate last night, this is the definition of sexual assault. Do you understand this? That's what Anderson Cooper asked Trump. And this seems to show that maybe Susan Hutchinson didn't quite understand what is said on that tape. It is, according to the Justice Department, the criminal definition of sexual assault. So is it a fireable offense? Some people, Chris Vance, a man who really seems to have a conscience among Republicans in this state, was appalled by her reaction to that.
Tim, I get an email from a listener complaining about balance when it comes to this election. Are you objective? Are you balanced?
Well, you know, I'm an opinion columnist right now, so I've been writing an opinion column for almost 7 years, and I'm paid to have an opinion, so of course I'm not balanced. I have an opinion. But you have seen a real shift on the news side. For the first time in its history, the New York Times printed verbatim Trump's use of the F word in that tape. They just printed it on page one. My colleagues and I were just, wow.
Is the news side of the New York Times trying to keep Trump out of office?
No, they're not trying to keep Trump out of office, but they realize that he's a special character. It calls for special times. And so you have to go, he's so good at using the media that you have to go outside of the normal false equivalence thing. So that's what's changed. I think people are really willing to call him out. And in real time and in the sentences as he speaks them, people now say, in the cryons you see on CNN, they now say this is a false statement. That's changed. On the opinion side, I mean, opinions, you know, nothing's really changed in that sense.
If you could, you're a journalist, if you could blow the lid off one story about this campaign, secret Trump tapes or Clinton emails or whatever, what's the first story you'd want to bring to light because the voters deserve to know more than we do?
Yeah, it's a tough question because so many good stories have been done showing that he's a fraud, that his business has failed. He hasn't paid any taxes. He has his ties made in China. He mistreats women. He speaks low of immigrants, of African Americans. I mean, these stories have all been done and they haven't diminished him. So I think.
Haven't they?
This diminished him somewhat, but he's got a core 40%. To me, a larger story is what's happened to America. How can 40% of the United States, good God-fearing people, the Ned Flanders of the world, hear a man who's running for president say he wants to jail his opponent, which is banana Republicanism, as they say. And that's why so many Republicans are running for the exits right now. I heard it compared to a fire in a theater, and they're trying to get out rather quickly. Now, that's Beltway talk somewhat. Is the rest of the country with us? So to answer your question, I don't think there's one WikiLeaks. No, WikiLeaks is trying to get rid of Clinton. But I don't think there's one apprentice tape there that's going to kill Donald Trump, because nothing that comes out there is going to do anything except for reinforce what we already know about him. So if something comes out that shows he's racist, he's made that statement himself with his reaction to the judge, Judge Curiel. If something comes out like it did showing he's further sexist, he's proven that in his own words. The larger question, Bill, is how can 40% of the country see all this and accept it? We used to think these things were fringe things.
What's your answer to that question?
I think we have changed. I think globalization has been so disruptive of some people. I think the rules of civility, the biggest challenge we'll have after the election is, can we restore civility somewhat? Have we broached so many of these walls? Have we crossed so many of these boundaries? Can we put back together that thin little thing that ties us together? You know, which is civility, which is not speaking what you always think, which is not using the F word to talk to people, which is not calling people by their group association, whether they're Latino or a woman or gay or something like that. We've crossed all those boundaries.
Has Trump's candidacy made us more uncivil, or has it revealed the lack of civility?
Yeah, that's a PhD question. I actually think it's a little bit of both. It's always been there, but you've been discouraged in proper society from saying it. And what it used to be, as they say, George Will, I'll give him credit for this line. Trump was the guy. Every town has a guy like Trump in the bar at the end of the bar, muttering to himself about the damn Mexicans or this or that. What Trump has done is elevated that and given them a community. So it's not really, I don't think it's a one produced the other.
Are we not giving ourselves enough credit that it used to be slavery and genocide and lynching and women can't vote and on and on and on compared to today?
Oh, you mean have we not evolved?
Well, we've evolved, yeah. But when we talk about, well, my God, what's happened to us?
Right.
We've always been flawed. Humans have been flawed. America's been flawed. Do you see what's your vision of where we're going?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I've always been on the side of we're moving toward the Martin Luther King line, that the arc moves towards justice and toward betterment. And clearly our history is that. You know, the founders made African Americans three-fifths of human beings. Women couldn't vote. On and on and on. The oligarchs of the Gilded Age. We have so many things that have progressed us right now. But the interesting thing to me right now, well, one of the many things, is the immigrant thing. So that we're all immigrants. It was all our story, our national story. How can our own national story be questioned as it is being now? I still think we're moving forward, but I think there's going to be a huge, to go back to my first metaphor, which was a storm, huge cleanup and recovery period after this storm. Have so many things been broken that they can't put back together?
Will you come back and keep talking to us about storm recovery? Really?
I'll try to expand the metaphor.
Okay. New York Times opinion, as you say, opinion columnist Tim Egan joining us today. Tim, final words? You're going to go out and continue to cover this campaign. A final thought to leave us with?
Well, excuse me. I want to put in a word for Ken Bone, who's
Ken Bone,
guy in the red sweater. He's
yes, really, if you watched the nice debate guy last night.
One thing your listeners may not have known, there's a mildly breaking story on Ken Bone, who came in as an undecided voter. He came out, he said he's now leaning towards Hillary.
Okay. Ken Bone leans Hillary.
Right.
All right. Tim Egan, great to see you in Seattle. Thanks
for having me.
New York Times columnist based in Seattle, Tim Egan. On the record here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Writer Maria Semple dropped a bestseller on us 4 years ago now. Where'd You Go, Bernadette? Was a tour de force of a story, but also a funny take on what Seattleites take so seriously. Now her new novel is out. It's called Today Will Be Different. And Maria, I think you might be softening on Seattle a little.
I think I might be, too.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming in. You know, for listeners who didn't read Bernadette, if anyone, what was your take on Seattle then?
My take on Seattle was similar to Bernadette's in that I had moved here from Los Angeles and I felt very misunderstood by the city. I'd come from the world of comedy writing where people were very mean-spirited and shallow, and I loved it. And I came up here and I was not seeing much of that. And so I...
What did we misunderstand about you?
Well, I would drop off my daughter at school, and I thought I would be making basic conversation with the other moms, and they would say, tell us what you really think.
Uh-huh.
And, or, hey, you better switch to decaf. And I thought, hey, what did I do? I'm just sitting here making a conversation with you and trying to get out as quickly as possible. Mm-hmm. But somehow, something came across that they didn't approve of.
What was it like to run into those private school parents, et cetera, after having lampooned them?
I at first thought that I should cover my face and cross the street before they saw me. But one of the really touching things over the last 4 years is how much Seattle has embraced the book. And I think the book really does have a kindness in its heart. The antipathy towards Seattle in Where'd You Go, Bernadette was very much an expression of how messed up Bernadette was at the time, that she had a lot of personal problems and personal failings as an artist that she was not able to deal with. So she instead blamed an entire city of people who she'd never met. And by the end of the book, to me, it's the signal that Bernadette was whole and happy and was going to be okay, because I think the last maybe two or three pages of that book is really a love letter to Seattle.
And before we round up Bernadette and move on to Eleanor, we talked a little bit about the, I don't know what you call that attitude, the passive-aggressive, discomfort with mean slash nice, but let's widen out your take on Seattle, because there was a lot.
Yeah, there was. It was, I think that it was very liberal, which... It was just this fervent tolerance of everything, you know, just people kind of falling over themselves to be more tolerant of the next person. And I would like to say it had more of a philosophy behind it, but really it mainly had to do with the fact that driving around, I couldn't figure out how to cross the 5 freeway. I felt the street grid was so completely confusing that really was the beginning of me turning on Seattle.
So your narrator, Eleanor, in your new book, Today Will Be Different, reminded me of Seattle in that we're trying to be better. And it's stressful to try to be better. What's your take on Eleanor? What were you trying to get at in this go round, in this take on comic neuroses?
I wanted to write a book about a woman who was trying to go through the day and only be the better version of herself, not set a higher goal than that, just to look people in the eye, to be present, to not get into these dog fights with her kid, not push the buttons of her kid, and to try to treat her husband like she was still in love with him. And it was it's a very low bar, and kind of comically low. But then life happens, and it starts going awry on her.
I said at the very beginning that I think maybe you're softening on Seattle, and I read into it at least a softening or an empathizing or an even falling for Seattle. What's your take been since Bernadette is, because you're still living here?
I love Seattle, and in fact, at the end of writing Bernadette, I was really starting to love Seattle, and I'd had to ward off those happy thoughts because I still needed to write this poisonous take on Seattle, so I had to push that aside. But in this book, Eleanor is certainly much more engaged with Seattle than I would say Bernadette was. Bernadette was an agoraphobic who was locked up in this airstream in her backyard. And Eleanor, and Today Will Be Different, is very much of the city and is going around and engaging with Seattle. Now, of course, to engage with Seattle is to be frustrated by Seattle, but she is not defined by her antipathy to the city.
What do you want Seattle to be like if you could wave your wand? Because we don't want to be New York. I mean, you write about New York and New Orleans in this book.
Yes.
Those are the two other big city characters,
right?
And we don't want to be New York, and we don't want to be New Orleans. So, what would you like Seattle to be?
I like how funky it is and how the neighborhoods still maintain their personalities. My daughter went to school in Wallingford, and I went there for maybe 6 years while she was in elementary school, and I hadn't been there for 2 years, and I just went back, and I was really shocked at how along 45th alone, a lot of these funky little storefronts are now those big mixed-use condo buildings.
Mm-hmm.
And so I even saw driving down, I think it was 2nd Avenue today, or something called the Seneca Building, which actually, I don't know if it's on 1st or 2nd, but it seemed like it had really old world charm, and it seemed like it should have been a landmark building. And then instead, there's a big white sign up saying it's getting demolished, and next to it, this huge glass skyscraper. And just these brick front stores are going away, and it's all just this awful aluminum siding and just junk. And so I hate to think that there's not a Landmarks Commission working and realizing that these old buildings, maybe they're not built by famous architects or anything. You'd like to think that someone understands that's part of the character of our city.
Do you think we're sliding toward what we didn't want to be?
I guess so. I mean, I don't quite know what we want to be. I haven't been here long enough. I've only been here for 8 years. And it's one of those things you get here and you remember, you start to say, I remember when, and there's always someone to trump you to say, oh, no, I remember when you got here, it was already ruined, you know. So
yeah.
I can't really speak to what Belltown was like before we got to Belltown. You know, I know what Belltown has been in the last 8 years. And there's great restaurants. You know, there's some good things about it, and that I love all our restaurants, and there's still a lot of thriving culture, and people are nice, and thank God they have those hanging flower baskets everywhere. Those don't seem to be going anywhere. As long as those are up and healthy, then I'll keep my mouth shut.
There is a new crop of Seattleites to judge, the blue-badged Amazon squids, as Eleanor calls them. I mean, between privileged people who own beautiful homes worth millions and privileged people who make six figures in their 20s, who do you dread more?
Gee, that's a good question. Maybe the young people, only
yeah.
because I feel like they don't know about basic manners. I feel like nobody's taught manners, and I think the old school people, I think that my generation, I'm considering myself an old person, is we remember a time before cell phones and before computers, and I feel like we're the last people with one foot in basic civility.
Beyond Seattle quirks and comedy, is there anything you wanted to tell our listeners about what you're trying to say in Today Will Be Different? Because at times I found it moving, and it's really thoughtful.
Thank you. I never quite know what I want to write about. I would say that when I start out, I write a character, and my character is someone who starts the day really guided by self-will. She's really willing herself to be a better person. Today will be different. It's an incantation in the beginning of the book. Today will be different. Today will be different. And almost by having to say it so much, you have to realize there might be some fundamental flaw in it, that she has to almost convince herself of it. And so what I found was, just during the course of the book, and this was maybe after reading the book on the third or the fourth draft, it occurred to me that it's a journey from self-will to letting go. And I think that that's at least something that I hope I'm on that path towards. But at the same time, if I ever get to the letting go place, I don't know why that doesn't mean I'm just going to be lying in bed eating chocolates and watching MSNBC, because if I let go, that's probably what I would be doing, left to my own devices. So the difference between letting go but and being an artist, and I all of those issues are interesting to me, and I think that there's some of the things brought up in the book.
Well, I found Eleanor's son to be pretty damn philosophical, and I found, we won't give it away, I guess, but I found her Seahawk doctor's husband Joe's epiphany to be a very not what we think of as a Seattle story. We're kind of the opposite of that in Seattle, but we get to see Bernadette's sequel. We get to see Eleanor go through quite a day.
That's right.
Yeah. Thanks for writing it. Thanks for the entertaining read and for coming in.
Thank you.
KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Today is not Columbus Day in Seattle. It's the third annual Indigenous Peoples Day. The person who wrote the City of Seattle's Indigenous Peoples Day resolution is Lakota member Matt Remley.
I mean, so much of our history from public schools and mainstream media, even alternative media, is virtually erased, right? So having a day like Indigenous Peoples Day is puts us kind of front and center. Like we're not the vanished Indian. We're not, we're still here. We're still vibrant. We're still thriving. We're still surviving despite the things that have happened over the past several hundred years and despite the things that are currently happening. You know, a lot of the issues that have impacted us over the past few hundred years with treaty violations, you know, those sort of things still happen. You know, one just look at the Dakota Access Pipeline and you could see that these things are still ongoing. But a lot of the kind of non-native world doesn't, you know, a lot of times even know that we exist. So this is our way of bringing out our drums, bringing out our songs, being proud of who we are, and showing the rest of the non-native world that, you know, we're still here, we're still thriving, and we're still maintaining who we are as Native people.
What do you want our listeners to do today on Indigenous Peoples Day?
I want them to, one, look at wherever they're living on the homelands, or they're settled on the homelands of a Native people. So if it's here in Seattle, it's the Duwamish people. So wherever they are, you know, find out who the original peoples of that land are. You know, respect them, honor them, learn their history, learn their cultures. Do whatever they can to support and uplift the Native peoples of those lands. So, and then to celebrate, you know, because Indigenous folks, you know, we're throughout the world. And I encourage all listeners to stop and listen to what Indigenous peoples have to say and what we have to offer to benefit the world.
Matt Remley, author of Seattle's Indigenous Peoples Day Resolution, and tonight at 5 o'clock at the Daybreak Star Indian Cultural Center in Discovery Park, you can celebrate the holiday. Author Sherman Alexie will be there, as well as Native Hawaiian dancers and a salmon bake. It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. How good are the undefeated Washington Huskies? Here are some numbers. Ranked number 5 in America. Just snapped a 12-year losing streak against Oregon with a 70-21 victory. And here's another number people are bringing up, 1991. As in the 91 Huskies team that won a national championship. Lincoln Kennedy played on that team, then went on to the NFL. He's a radio analyst now. Lincoln Kennedy, thanks for coming to KUOW.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
For people who don't know, how big a deal is beating Oregon and beating Oregon by 50 points?
Yeah, well, I would say if people who are familiar with Husky football don't know how big this is, they probably haven't been around Husky football for long. The fact is that Oregon has been a pain, a nemesis, and UW's side for the last decade and some change, 12 years to be exact. It's a big deal for Washington football because it's a hurdle that had to be overcome in order to look for the future and to say that, you know, the future seems bright and promising.
Is it less thrilling because Oregon doesn't seem that good? It's not like beating U of O from a few years ago.
No, I don't think it's less thrilling. I think it's gratifying in its own way. Look, if you've had entire classes that have gone through a program, the UW program, and not beating Oregon, which has happened, this reward is very sweet. And for an alum like myself who was watching the game from the studio of the Pac-12 Network, I sat there and said, I wish they would put 100 on them. Keep it going. Keep the starters in there. Throw it down the field again.
Rub it in. What was it like in Seattle for you when Husky football was king in this town?
I remember specifically going to a nightclub in downtown, and I remember seeing some of the Seahawks in line trying to get into the club. And here comes me with a couple of my teammates, and we walk right up to the front of the line, and the bouncers let us in. It was almost fighting terms. I mean, think about it. It was like you got Seahawks that are standing outside trying to get inside while you got some college kids that are just walking up. I mean, Seattle is a great sports town, as you already know. And when you're on top, you've got anything and everything that you could possibly want. And that's how it was. That's how it was for us back in those days. We were the greatest show in town. We were the biggest party, and we were celebrated everywhere because every game was a party. Every time we were on TV, you know, everybody reveled in us, and I mean, we were getting dinners and everything. This is left and right. It was our town.
Is this Husky team as good, better than 91? What do you see?
I'm not going to say they're better than us. Come on now. Let's not be that.
It's a little early.
That's a little early. I think they're good. I really do think they're on track to make some things happen and to move in the right direction. But our day was a little different. Don James, may he rest in peace, would only talk about winning the conference and winning the Rose Bowl. Today's standards, the bar has been raised significantly. You know, to be honest, what's sad about it is that people look down the schedule, and if a team finishes 11-1 or 10-2 because they're not hoisting up the national championship trophy, some people look at it as a disappointment and a failed season, and I think that's wrong. Do I think this is a national championship caliber team? Well, I would like to think so, but they obviously got to play some teams that are a whole lot better than the ones they face. And more importantly, it's not the Oregons or the Stanfords that I'm concerned about. It's the Cows. They struggled against Arizona, as you saw in the desert. And it's the Wazoos that I'm concerned about, because a lot of times for these young men, it's hard to keep emotionally hyped every single game that you have to do, that we had to do in 91 when we won our national championship. We came out with a chip on our shoulder. You're not going to respect us, then we're going to take it from you. And then we went on a tear for that undefeated season.
Well, thanks for reminiscing with us. I sure remember the days, and it's fun to be talking about the Huskies in that kind of air again. Lincoln Kennedy, thanks.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Former Husky football star, offensive lineman Lincoln Kennedy, played on that 1991 UW team. 25 years ago, they went 11-0 and shared a national championship, and he went on to play in the NFL. By the way, if you've never watched a Huskies game, you might only know Lincoln Kennedy as a name on the wall at Schultz's, the U District sausage joint, where 25 years ago, a young Lincoln Kennedy ate a record-setting 11 brats. We talked about that a little. He's got mixed feelings. He certainly remembers what happened next. I'll just say he hasn't touched a bratwurst since. It's KUOW Seattle. Now on with the news on KUOW's listener-supported The Record. A proposal in front of the Seattle City Council would allow homeless people to camp in public parks and along miles of city sidewalks. Earlier this year, Portland tried something similar, only to kill that experiment after 6 months. Reporter Amelia Templeton with Oregon Public Broadcasting told me the Portland measure failed because the rules around it were unenforceable.
So, for example, people were supposed to camp in groups of six or less. And by the end of the summer, you know, we had encampments of sometimes 60 or 70 or 80 people all in a single field and all of the impact that comes with that. And the rules also included that people were supposed to take their tents down every day and then set them up again in the evening. I have to say, I don't think I ever saw that happen once in the time that I spent covering homelessness in the city. And so on the one hand, the public had this expectation that these rules were going to be followed and that might help minimize the impact. And when that didn't happen, I think it really turned the public very hard against this experiment.
So campers weren't obeying the rules. Why is that the fault of the rules?
Well, I think you have to be realistic about the population that we're talking about and some of the things that we're dealing with. That comes with a lot of baggage. It comes with drug addiction. It comes with, in some cases, mental illness and trauma. And there are also people who are pretty desperate and, you know, kind of scraping by. And so the notion that you're going to get up every morning and take your tent down at 8 o'clock in the morning, I just think it may seem really simple, but I think it's not necessarily a realistic expectation for everybody. And particularly, there wasn't really any enforcement. The Portland police weren't, I think, comfortable enforcing these rules. So the legal underpinnings of the rules were really unclear. And I think that made any kind of attempt to enforce them fraught for people like police or social workers who were out there trying to make it work.
I'm sure there's a debate about this in Portland, Amelia, but what's the lesson for Portland and for Seattle?
To me, I think there's two parts to the lesson. And the first part is, you have to recognize that if you're doing this, there will be impacts on neighbors and there will be impacts on communities. There will be trash, there will be noise, there will be other public impacts, and you really have to have a realistic strategy for how you're going to mitigate that and how you're going to deal with complaints. Otherwise, you get a situation where, you know, the public can really turn against this kind of thing. And, you know, we even had a situation in Portland where allegedly somebody put a homemade explosive device under a camper of a homeless family in East Portland. And the tension and the escalation of the frustration and the really negative attitudes about homeless people, it entrenched in the city, I think there needs to be a plan for how to avoid that and how to not have this just reinforce everybody's stereotypes and everybody's frustration.
Portland was starting, as Seattle is, with there weren't enough shelters. There weren't places for people to go to. That was the idea behind the mayor letting people camp in certain places. Was there any way that that could have been designed better so that people could camp since they didn't have another place to go, but it didn't get out of control?
You know, I do think the city could have done more to mitigate the impacts of this kind of camping. So, for example, they did place some dumpsters near a few of the larger places where people congregated on the Springwater Corridor bike path. Those weren't nearly enough. When they came through and actually moved people out of the camps, they carried away dumpster load after dumpster load of garbage. And that's the kind of thing that really set the community against this. And so I think having a really practical, really aggressive approach to how you deal with things like trash and drug use, I would say, would be the two, you know, primary community concerns. That, I think, would have improved the way that it played out in Portland, for sure.
That is Oregon Public Broadcasting reporter Amelia Templeton, who's followed that story in Portland about Portland's, as she said, failed experiment to let homeless camps exist on public land. The Seattle City Council is considering a proposal this week that's similar, and we're going to look more into this and tell you more about similarities and differences among these approaches to homelessness and what might make the difference between successful and failed policies. We'll continue to cover that here on KUOW's The Record.